ask you about the myths of financial freedom.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of myths. There's a lot of things that people, you know, they want to push their way of achieving financial freedom. But to become that millionaire that we all think is so difficult to achieve, it's not as difficult as I think as many of us believe it to be. But instead, it's about discipline saving, living below your means. And I love to talk about this one, is the myth that achieving financial freedom is going to eliminate all of your financial stress. Mm-hmm. And I can really talk to this because going back again to that first role that I held, where I saw people, you know, inherit or come into a large sum of money, the way that we talk about money, everyone would say that person is never going to stress again. And they're never going to have financial stress. Right. But I saw that they still had stress, and maybe it morphed into a different type of stress, but it doesn't go away. And oftentimes it's still related to money. So you can build this money up and you think, once I see a certain number on the screen, I can't imagine I'll feel stressed anymore. But that's not the case, because now you have the stress of, oh, I have to hold on to this. I have to keep it. I have to manage it right. And what if I lose it? And so there is still financial stress that many people experience. And no matter how logical you can be or rational or how much research you can show them, it doesn't go away.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest topic of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, and investment advisor to wealth creators with patient capital and an infinite investment horizon. I work with families and individuals who aspire to grow wealth over a lifetime and generations through disciplined, thoughtful investments in durable, quality businesses while giving money meaning. Join me on this quest to unearth and share the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. Money is a difficult topic, so when I meet someone who can make it easier, I can't wait to have them on the show. Rachel Camp is a certified financial planner and owner and founder of Camp Wealth, a financial planning firm for high earners and entrepreneurs. She graduated from Indiana University Kelly School of Business with a degree in finance and spent her entire career in financial services. She created Camp Wealth when she realized financial advisors weren't providing the service that solopreneurs and high earners really need. I've been enjoying her thoughtful writing for a while now, and I've been curious to have a deep discussion with Rachel about a variety of money topics and more. Today, Rachel shares how her clients often realize they need less than they thought to have their dream life. Rachel shared with me the common myths associated with financial freedom. I found it refreshing and inspiring to hear that it's not all about beating the index, but creating an environment that encourages discipline and consistent investing. Rachel explains how investing, when it's hard to invest, is a way to increase performance. Stay tuned until the end when my guest reveals some alternatives to traditional retirement. Finally, Last but not least, Rachel tells me how sometimes she uses her time away in a cabin in the mountains with no internet and TV to look for inspiration. We take on some big ideas today. Please enjoy it and help me welcome Rachel Camp. Hi, Rachel. How are you? It's so nice to see you.
I'm good. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm doing great. As you know, I'm a big fan. I've been reading your writing, and I mentioned it to you how you have a way of explaining things that usually people find intimidating, but you have a way with words that make those things, I think, more accessible, digestible, and less intimidating. So I love that style. Let's jump right in. I want to ask you about those early days, if you indulge me. I'm always curious about my guests and their childhood and upbringing and how you think that time influenced your career path that you're on right now, and especially your relationship with money.
Yeah, it's so interesting, you know, to look back, to know where we are today in our behaviors, and then try to kind of create this path looking backwards of how did I get here? Why do I think the way that I do? I consider myself a very introspective person. So when I do things that I think are a bit illogical, I'll ask myself quite a bit, why is that? Where do I think this has come from? So I have thought a lot about this, and especially when it comes to money. I think for a while, and something I still struggle with, is a scarcity mindset. And I think this is actually what helps me with a lot of my clients, because I notice a lot of people who come to me have a very similar struggle. So of course, when this happens, we think back to our childhood and think, what could have happened during that time for me to feel this sense of insecurity around money? And, you know, I don't know exactly what it was. I do think, so I had a single mom who raised myself and two of my siblings. And it was during the time where my parents got divorced and my mom was a homemaker previously, where I saw for a few years, you know, she really struggled. And there, I have to assume there's something that clicked within me to see that lack of financial security she had really impacted her. And of course, you know, not having that job, having to go back out to the workforce. And there was a lot of insecurity for a few years with that, with my family. So I think that has a large impact on the career choice I made, the fact that I always wanted to have a good income, and the fact that I always wanted to build up my net worth and have stability as quickly as possible. So much of what I do now and the decisions I make are around control over my life, around security and feeling like, you know, if anything were to happen, I would be okay and that I don't have to rely on somebody else. There's some aspects of that that are very true and some of it that's not the healthiest, you know, mindset to have. But when I look back, I think that has had to have had the largest impact on me and the way that I view money.
It's that idea of having a bit of a buffer. I think in a lot of your writing, I see that how, you know, even having a month worth of expenses saved and 6 months, it makes you think about your choices differently. You're more at ease. Maybe a certain conversation with your boss will go in a different way and you feel like, well, I have those 6 months to find something else. I think that's, it has an intangible value. I like the idea of giving money meaning. And I think that kind of money has a huge importance in our life. Not the multi-million dollar fortune, but that first 6 months, I think that really changes how we look at things. Sure. Tell me about Camp Wealth newsletter and tell me more about how you focus on solopreneurs and high earners. Tell me more about the inspiration behind it and the kind of clients you focus on.
Yeah, and the Camp Wealth newsletter has morphed a bit over the past year that I've been writing it. But one thing has always remained the same, and that's been, it's always been about taking control of your time and owning your time and your schedule. So no matter who I've written to in the past, because it started off with just being very general, basic personal finance advice, but it was always about having control over your time and using money as a means to do that. and having these resources actually guide us to that path where you can wake up and you have ownership eventually over your schedule. So I found the people really most interested in that, they're probably high earners, and a lot of them are business owners. So a lot of the people I talk to, and this includes myself, took this path of chasing a job where, you know, maybe we're climbing the corporate ladder and that's leading to a higher and higher income. Or maybe we left and we started a business because we wanted to start control over our schedule as soon as possible. So this was a message I realized really resonated with fellow business owners and also high earners. And so I talk about the different strategies that we can use within personal finance to achieve this goal. There's a lot of different ways to get there. But I try to focus on the different tips, tools, strategies that you can use to get there as soon as possible, because that is a goal for many of these high earners and business owners.
There's this idea that time is money. I even wrote an article about it. I saw it at the airport in Zurich, written, and kind of reminded me it's that one truth that we think is universal. But when the closer you look, the more I realize that time is not necessarily equal to money, because somebody pointed out to me how you can always borrow money and make it back if you lost it. But time, you can't do either of those two things. Mm-hmm. So as much as we put a money price on time and sell our time per hour sometimes, right, then it's very misleading, because you feel like they're equal, but they're not.
Yeah, there's a balance. So a lot of the time, I will have somebody who wants to achieve financial freedom as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And they're basically sacrificing everything today to do that. And I don't necessarily think that's the best path to take. I think we have to learn to appreciate today, to not sacrifice everything today, to not delay all of our, you know, our what makes us happy today. Mm-hmm. And to strike a balance between how can we enjoy today while also taking care of our future selves. And it's a very delicate balance that you have to work through.
You use the term future self. There's a book, I'm forgetting the author. Hal, do you know the book? Hal Hirschfeld, I think is the name.
I don't know.
I read the book, and it talks about how the self of today and the self in the future, is it the same person? And it's kind of a nice, interesting philosophical discussion in the book, because certain things that you do today will have an impact on your future self, right? Like the way you treat your body, the way you treat your, you know, savings and so on. So there's a moment where you have to pause, where you make a decision that's good for you today, and it's good for that future self. I had Luca Dallana on the show, who writes about ergodicity, but he had this one line where he said, when we make decisions, there's this idea, how would you live your life if this was your last day? And I also think it's not a fair question to ask, because what he proposes, he says, think about it as if you were to live one day or 50 years. And in both cases, it's a pretty good decision. And I think it's a more helpful way of looking at things. What's good for you today? Get that coffee if you want to get that coffee. What's good for you 50 years from now? Rearrange your budget in a way that you do have something at the end of the month. I think that's helpful to look at. There's this one thought that you share in one of your essays where you say that your clients often realize they need less than they thought to have their dream life. Tell me more about that, because I feel like the dream life is always out of reach.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So my favorite meeting I have with my clients is the very first meeting after they've become a client. This is a goals and values meeting. And so before we get into the numbers and all the details, I like to know, where are we going? What's important to you? And just to understand them a bit more. So a lot of these questions I ask, what's an ideal day to you? What's something that you do not have today that you want, or something that you actually have today, but you no longer want? And I find a lot of these clients actually struggle to think of anything that would be, you know, different than the life they're already living. Maybe some minor tweaks, like, yes, I'd like to work a little bit less. I'd like to spend a little bit of time with my family. But a lot of what they're doing, they've realized, is very close to what an ideal day is. And for many of them, the little minor tweaks that maybe they could make to bring it to an even better day, they could actually afford to make those changes today. So the most surprising thing is some of these changes my clients want to make, first of all, they're already really close. But the changes that they do want to make, they just haven't given themselves permission to do it yet, even though they could afford it, even though it really won't impact their finances that much. And I consider that a really important part of my job is just to be the person and to say, hey, I have the expertise to say this. You can do this now and you will still be fine.
It's almost more about rearranging your life a little bit rather than hitting a certain goal, you know, doubling your income. That's good too, but I think sometimes it's rearranging things. It's interesting because in this podcast with a lot of guests, we start talking about money. And then quickly enough, we start talking about time. And sometimes 3/4 of the conversation is about time. How do you actually spend your time? Do you do what you like? And what are the choices you make about how you spend your time? I think it's really interesting when you pause for a second and you say what you mentioned is how you can rearrange the pieces so that they fit better. And maybe it's not all about doubling your income, although I hope everybody listening finds a way to do that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to say, I think when you're really good at delaying gratification, like many of the clients I work with are, they're very successful, very high earners or very successful business owners. They're so good at that, that they think that there's always something that they have to sacrifice for their future selves. And to an extent, that might be a little bit true. But I think it is a hard switch to flip to say, I actually have built this life, you know, for the past 10 years, and it's created the point to where I can realize a lot of these goals I had 10 years ago, but I'm not in the habit of switching that flip and realizing it. I'm in the habit of, I have to continue to work. I have to continue to grind. It's always some distant future that I can realize that goal. So that is just one of the more difficult things, is what got them to that point of being really great at delayed gratification is now what's harming them and what's making it really difficult to enjoy a lot of the work that they've already put in.
I like that. There's a book, Die With Zero, something along those lines. Yeah. Is it Bill Perkins, I think? And the one big takeaway for me from the book was that life is about collecting experiences. And I also like the idea that experiences pay dividends over time. The trip to Paris you took 10 years ago, you're still thinking about it. When you sit down with friends, you still mention it and they remember it, right? So sometimes that sacrifice of saying, you know, just saying no to everything, maybe it's not worth it at the end of the day. I wrote a short piece that I called Precious Dollars, and I was trying to explain how the dollars that you get to invest at the end of the day are the dollars that stayed behind after all the taxes, expenses, all the choices. So they're really precious, and you should give them some thought. So even if it's $100 at the end, maybe it started as $2,000 after all the things that had to happen for the $100 to stay. So once you decide what kind of investments you're going to make, how are you going to treat that $100? I'd like to pause for a second and see that it's pretty significant that it's still there after everything, all the other claims on your money that had to take place. You mentioned financial freedom, and I really like the concept. And I had Brad Barrett on the show a while ago, and we talked about it quite a bit. And I think he's you know, quite an expert in the field. You talk about the 5 levels of financial freedom in one of your essays that I found really intriguing. Can you talk about what they are and how we reach them? And I think in a way, some of them might be closer to us than the other ones. So maybe that gives some encouragement to the listeners.
Well, and I did not create these levels. This is all from the FIRE movement, the Financial Independence Retire Early movement. There's, you know, been some criticism of the movement, and I've actually been a part of that at times, and that what we were just talking about, sometimes the movement encourages too much of delayed gratification and too much sacrifice today and no, you know, room for enjoying the present day. But I do think the movement is shifting and evolving to include that. And some of my favorite things from the movement have been some of these terms that they've coined. And I think they can be really motivating. I actually ended up writing about this when I realized I had hit kind of that first level. And it had a really dramatic impact on my mindset and the way that I I started approaching life after realizing this. And that first level is Coast Fire. Mm-hmm. So Coast Fire is at the point where you have saved enough money now that without adding another dollar to your investments, this money, assuming a certain return on it, should carry through to whatever retirement age goal you had in mind, should mm-hmm. grow enough to where you can hit that retirement age and that money, you can live off the income from that money. So mm-hmm. you no longer have to continue saving. And now it's about just covering your current living expenses rather than continuing to save, which of course you can, but now it's no longer necessary. And so I realized I hit this and, you know, going back to the earlier talk around childhood, I'm not too surprised I hit it earlier than some people do, because I did have this mindset around wanting to save a lot of money and wanting to build up my net worth. And I've questioned that decision a bit. Should I have maybe taken more trips? Should I have been less strict with my budget? But now I'm so thankful to be in this position, because as a business owner and somebody who has to be willing to take more risks and rather take money and invest it back into the business rather than the stock market, hitting this level of Coast Fire has made me really comfortable to do that, knowing that I have these investments that are going to grow and take care of me. And now I just have to worry about covering living expenses. So it's freed me up a lot. And I think I've noticed other people have hit this number and it's done the same thing for them. So it's important to recognize when you're there. But that's level one. It's the easiest one to hit, although it's no small feat. Level two is Barista Fire. Mm-hmm. So this is essentially a form of partial retirement. So you get to retire and maybe you take a portion from your portfolio, but you still need a part-time job to supplement your income or to cover your health insurance. If you're in the US, health insurance is one of the most difficult parts about retiring early. It's really expensive. And it's really, in the US especially, it's really closely tied to your job. So a lot of people will retire early, but still keep a part-time job, maybe because they enjoy it, but also to get that health insurance and to supplement a portion of their income if their portfolio can't cover it entirely. So that's level two. And then level three is Lean Fire. This is the quickest way to fully retire. And this is essentially living off the bare minimum. So when I picture somebody who is in Lean Fire, the person I always picture is somebody who retires into a van and living very frugally, not having many expenses, not traveling internationally, but just living at the bare necessities, maybe going home to their family quite a bit and staying with them. But this person usually, you know, wants to retire as soon as possible, but they probably don't enjoy their job. They want to retire or maybe just take a sabbatical. So they're willing to do it in a really frugal way. And maybe they don't care about, you know, extra things that some of us might care about, like an apartment or a home. So that is the quickest way to actually fully retire. But there is some risk there that would scare me. The next one, traditional FIRE, level four, this is the one you hear most of us talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's the formula for it is 25 times living expenses. So this is where you're going to maintain your current standard of living. You're able to give yourself an inflation adjustment every year, but you're not decreasing your standard of living. You're not increasing your standard of living. You're just paying attention to what are my living expenses now. And again, the formula is multiply that by 25. That's your traditional FIRE number. Now, I know there's a lot of really smart people who don't think that's the best formula to rely on, but that's something we can get into another time. And then the final level, level five, is Fat Fire. And this is something that I would probably aim for, a lot of my clients aim for, because it leaves a lot of room for error. Mm-hmm. And it also allows you to retire into a life where you can actually increase your spending. So if you're, let's say you're not traveling first class right now, but that's something that you want to do. So you would include that in your budget, and your living expenses once you retire might actually increase, at least for a period of time. So it's the one that leaves the most margin of error for sure.
to me, the most powerful idea behind all of what you just shared and what the FIRE movement talks about is that there is a goal. There's a particular number. And you can play with the formula, and we'll talk more about it in a minute. But I think it's very empowering to know that there's a number that you can work your way towards, thinking how much do I have to save each year? Because otherwise, the concept of financial freedom, it's very elusive. What does it mean? How will I know I got there? When people ask me, what does it mean to be rich? And I think we get those concepts confused. You know, looking rich, being rich, and feeling rich. People might be already rich, but they don't even realize. And your neighbors might think you're rich, but you only seem rich on the outside. Right? It's all those different ways of looking at being rich. We've been talking so far about investing over a lifetime. I call it a lifetime of, you know, contribution, slowly getting there, slowly getting rich. But there are moments when sudden wealth arrives, and you wrote quite a bit about handling a substantial amount of money, and whether it's an inheritance or a sale of a business or a pay package, but it's a life-changing moment. I realized from my experience working with, you know, families investing money for people, how it can be a very tricky point in time for them, because they have to make some big decisions fairly quickly. And there's, you mentioned room for error, but there's very little room for error when you're handling a large amount of money all of the sudden at the same time. Tell me more about that, handling a larger amount.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts around this. My very first job, I was on a team of advisors where this is all that they handled. They helped families and individuals that came into a large liquidity event. And that looks like a lot of different things that you mentioned. Could be an inheritance. For many of them, it was a sale of a business. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of psychological parts here that we have to consider. So for many of these people, they spent years building a business, and that's all that they know. Now, all of a sudden, they have this just sum of money that's replaced that. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that they're familiar with, and it can be a really scary time for them. So in what I wrote, I mentioned the very first thing you should do is hire a team of experts. Mm-hmm. So at one point, I was on a team where we were the experts around this, and we were bringing in other experts to help. And I could definitely see our value there. It's like I mentioned, this is a completely new experience for a lot of these people. Many of them weren't familiar with managing money. Instead, they were familiar with maybe managing real estate or managing a business, or have just never seen this amount of money. So I do think it's important to take a moment and to assemble this team of experts who can guide you through this, who have been through this many times before, can point out blind spots and pitfalls that many people fall into. And it's just an extremely important part or time to do this as soon as you possibly can. And then with that team of experts, you do want to create a plan. So this is going to include a plan for the money. It's going to consider short-term goals, intermediate-term goals, long-term goals. Does this money need to create an income for you for at least a little bit of time? And what are some of the other things, you know, that you might need to consider as far as taxes, insurance, estate planning, all of that? It all comes up at once when you have a large sum of money. So a team of experts will help you develop this plan. And then when you do go to invest, the step three typically is to invest based on your liquidity needs. So one thing I see some people wanting to do is to take this money and put it all right back into something that's really illiquid again. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the last things that you want to do, especially if you need a portion of this money to supplement or create an income for you for a little bit. So a lot of times business owners want to take this and put it all into another business or put it all into real estate. And I think it's important to sit down and to look at your plan and say, okay, if I need income, I cannot put this money somewhere where it's all going to be illiquid. I need to create, and my team did a lot of laddering where money would become liquid over different periods of time. And I think it's really important to think about that when you have a large sum of money. And then step four would be to follow the financial plan. So this is where we're actually going to implement the plan and make sure that you can stick to the plan. So there's one part of you that can create a plan, and then there's another part of you that actually needs to implement and stick to the plan. Mm-hmm. And this is when emotions come into it. This is when you might you know, become scared to take the money and to invest it in something that you're not as familiar with. So it's important to have, again, that team of experts around you that can provide that gap in education and help you stick to the plan, think about it in a very logical way. And then I mentioned step five, tax planning, as its completely own step, because it is that important when you have a large sum of money come out of nowhere. There are a lot of tax strategies that you can use to try to minimize the tax impact, of course, in a legal way, you know, just paying what you need to pay in taxes and not a dollar more. And that's where a good accountant is going to come in and be able to help with that. A good attorney is going to be able to help you understand how to pass on assets in a tax efficient way. This is taxes when during a large liquidity event are going to be your largest expense. Mm-hmm. So it's worth investing in that topic, in that area, and understanding how can I minimize the tax impact. And you do have to move quickly with that, because usually you have to do it within the same year that you had the liquidity event. And then finally, very important step, I think, is to celebrate this large liquidity event. Like I mentioned, a lot of these people were business owners and spent years grinding away and building this business. And for many of them, again, like we were talking about earlier, it's hard to flip that switch and to say, okay, that was the time that I was grinding. Now I can at least celebrate a little bit. You don't have to go crazy. This can also be a pitfall if you go a little bit too crazy and want to blow the money. But I still think it's worth it. And for a lot of the clients, that was not the problem they had. The problem they had was not taking a moment to go celebrate with their family. And so I think that's a very important thing to consider when this happens to you.
You're touching on so many great topics here, but I notice how important it is when it's a sale of the original business to appreciate how much of the identity of the individual and the family was invested in that story. And it could have been a multi-generational business. Mm-hmm. So it's important to have those stories, and some people write them down. And I've seen clients really enjoy keeping those stories alive, because the capital goes on into a portfolio of investments, but the story where it came from, and usually it's one individual that started it off way mm-hmm. back, I think it's very important, because it adds what we spoke about earlier, the meaning to the money. It's money has meaning, and somebody made certain choices, sacrifices for the money to be here. So I think that's very important. I also think it's, you touched on it, how appreciate for a second that it could be a once in a lifetime situation. I think that's very hard to embrace, because people assume it may happen again. And I brought this up before in this podcast. There's a book, Brewster's Millions, from 100 years ago. I don't know if you read it. There was a movie made at some point, but the book is, mm-hmm. it's a short novel. But if you actually read it from the perspective that you and I have and are talking about today, it's a story of an individual that receives one inheritance and the second one. He has to waste away the first one to get the second one. Family conflict. But he learns so much through that 1 year of losing the first fortune that he's ready for the second one. And he kind of almost doesn't even need it or want it, mm-hmm. which is a lesson in itself. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful little book if you actually read it, not as a funny story, but as a human story of an actual real experience that happens again and again and again. But treat this money as something that will happen only once in a lifetime, and then make decisions. There's some things that you talked about that you kind of have to rush and do quickly, including mm-hmm. Tax planning with the right help. But the actual investments, I think it can go pretty slow. And especially mm-hmm. if you have first reaction is rush back into something illiquid and risky, pause for a second and think if this is really the right place. You know, I'm thinking of making money and keeping money as two different stages of that kind of fortune, and realize that I think you're wearing a different hat now. And you know how it's the capital, the rate of return, and time. You have the capital. You definitely have the time. The rate of return doesn't have to be as high as it was when you were creating the first million or 10 or 100, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. These are my quick thoughts, but
yeah, I agree completely. One of the very first things we recommend typically is to let that money sit there, because mm-hmm. it can have a really big impact on you. One, that may take a while for you to realize exactly what it is. And if we jump into making decisions, we're going to, of course, create a plan, talk about it, but actually implementing that plan, and, you know, outside of risk management, and to your point, investing the money, I do think it's important to take a moment to really see how this large sum of money is impacting you before you rush into decisions. So it can certainly be worth it to let the money sit there for a little bit.
And it will have a big impact. I've seen it. Yeah, it will. So it's good to appreciate it. I want to ask you about the myths of financial freedom. You talk about it quite a bit, and I'm curious, what are they? Because it's such a big topic, and there are some myths that came about that some people might be familiar with, and maybe it keeps them away from the topic because of those myths.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of myths, especially if you spend time on Twitter or X. There's a lot of things that people, you know, they want to push their way of achieving financial freedom. So it's always important to remember that there's many different ways to achieve this goal and to pay attention to the method that works best for you. One of the things, the myths that I've talked about is the myth that you have to have a high income. Now, you know, I mentioned I used to work with people who had large liquidity events. Right after that, I actually started working with retirees. So a different demographic here. And what I was able to see was that many of these retirees were your, you know, average next door millionaire, where you don't really realize, or the millionaire next door. That's it. That's the book. You don't realize that this person is a millionaire because maybe they don't drive the nicest car or have the nicest house. But what they're doing with their money is they're choosing to invest it and to let it grow. And there's a lot of lifestyle, you know, factors that we could get into with this decision. But the idea is, through disciplined, consistent investing, and usually starting pretty early, these people who never made maybe above six figures, I saw this all the time, were taking their money and investing it in a way to, once they've reached retirement, they are a millionaire or multimillionaire. And I saw it happen again and again. So I do think building dramatic levels of wealth, significant levels of wealth, is really hard without a high income or a business. But to become that millionaire that we all think is so difficult to achieve, it's not as difficult as I think as many of us believe it to be. But instead, it's about disciplined saving, living below your means. And I can really attest to that because I saw so many people achieve this when I was working with retirees. Another myth I go into is that financial freedom means never working again.
Right.
And this is one of the bigger myths, because something I've noticed among my generation, especially a lot of the clients I work with, is they don't actually have a goal to never work again. And personally, that's not a goal of mine. My goal is to never have to retire, but to maybe shift what I do, or to at least shift my mindset around how I work and not have to worry about the money impact of it, but maybe just the general impact of it and how many people can I actually help. So there's many different reasons for achieving financial freedom, and to achieve it to never work again, if that's your goal, is certainly possible. But for many of us, we don't have a goal of retirement, but we still want to achieve financial freedom, because there is a shift that happens, especially mentally, once you've realized you've hit the point where you never actually do have to work again. And there is an important difference there. Another myth I talk about, I love to talk about this one, is the myth that achieving financial freedom is going to eliminate all of your financial stress. And I can really talk to this because, going back again to that first role that I held, where I saw people, you know, inherit or come into a large sum of money, the way that we talk about money, everyone would say that person is never going to stress again. And they're never going to have financial stress. But I saw that they still had stress, and maybe it morphed into a different type of stress. but it doesn't go away. And oftentimes it's still related to money. So you can build this money up and you think, once I see a certain number on the screen, I can't imagine I'll feel stressed anymore. But that's not the case, because now you have the stress of, oh, I have to hold on to this. I have to keep it. I have to manage it right. And what if I lose it? And so there is still financial stress that many people experience. And no matter how logical you can be or rational or how much research you can show them, it doesn't go away. And there's a lot of reasons for that that we can get into. Finally, the last myth I mention is that financial freedom is easy to reach. And it is, why I mention this is because there's a lot of people on social media that promote a get rich quick scheme or seem to have a hack of, you know, ignore what everyone else is doing. This will get you there quickly. And I think it's important to emphasize that this is really difficult, whether you're building a business or you're building a real estate empire, or you're just consistently investing and you're going to remain an employee your whole life. Each method is difficult, because to achieve financial freedom outside of, you know, some one-time events like a lottery or inheritance, but for most of us, to achieve financial freedom requires decades of doing the same thing day in and day out, and it becomes really boring. And I tell people, if you're bored, you're doing it right. That's what investing is. If you're excited, then you might want to question what you're doing.
I like that. I feel like, to me, you know, I find investing fascinating, but that's not the place I go to look for excitement. It's the place where I go for intellectual stimulation, being, you know, curious and finding new things and, figuring out a new business model and trying to see how this new company is succeeding, what's the secret, and then when to buy it and so on. But none of it is really, it's my excitement because I like the pursuit, but it's not excitement in the sense that I want a lottery ticket here. It's not that that kind of excitement. But yeah, it's fascinating how there are some myths that I think stop people from even trying. And I think that's what I wanted to address. And I think you did a beautiful job explaining how it's not really about the income itself. It's about how much you're saving, right? You could be making $1 million and saving 10,000, and you could be making 50,000 and saving, you know, twice as much. So it's really about how much you're saving and what are you doing with that. And if it gets invested over a long period of time, even if it's very boring, it's going to grow. That's the beauty of compounding. I like this idea that somebody shared it. I think a couple of people, how, you know, we see Buffett as this multi-billionaire, but then the 99 or 98% of the wealth that he has today was created after his 55th or 65th birthday. And it gives you the, well, the visual of the actual compounding that's happening, although he started investing when he was 8 or 9 or 10. But then, you know, four decades later, he wasn't even where he's gonna be, right? So it takes decades. But that part, that it's a slow process, I think discourages a lot of people. There are ways to automate it. There are ways to just leave it in the background if you don't want to pay attention, if you don't want to spend too much time on it, but just let the snowball grow. I want to ask you about the 4% withdrawal rate that you touched on, and I know that you have some thoughts about it. I like it as just a very simple model. Like when somebody asks, what's the number? So you have a number, and I think the number can change and you might realize I need more, I need less, and all the varieties that you mentioned. But tell me more about how you look at the 4%, and you have some thoughts how you can kind of tweak it and see it in different ways.
Yeah. And to your point, this is maybe where we get a little bit nitpicky, and the 4% guideline is fine for some back of the envelope math and just understanding, you know, what's a goal that I need to hit. I think that's fine. But because I worked with retirees, I did have a lot of experience in how do we take this portfolio and turn it into income. And I thought about this more and more. I think after the book Die with Zero came out, I had a lot of people coming to me and saying, I don't want to end up with millions left behind. I want to spend my money, or I want to give it away in my lifetime. I want to see it being put to use. So because of that, and because of maybe my own thoughts around it, I really started to look into, you know, how can we are there approaches that we can take that maybe get us closer to dying with zero or dying? Mm-hmm. My conservative nature would never have that goal, but dying with, you know, spending more money during mm-hmm. your lifetime. Right. Because the thing with the 4% guideline is there is a less than 10% chance that you will end up with less than what you started with. So at the end of the your life, there's a less than 10% chance that you'll end up with less than what you started with when you retired. Mm-hmm. But there's a 2/3 chance that you will end up with double what you started with. Mm-hmm. So my issue with the 4% guideline is that it really solves for a worst case scenario. And too often it ignores, well, what if there's a good scenario or even an average scenario? What do we do then? Mm-hmm. And instead the 4% guideline continues to just solve for that worst case scenario. So what I prefer is a more dynamic approach to spending. Now it's difficult because we do have to be conservative, especially when we start retirement. There's a lot of research that shows that those first 5 years of retirement are the most important. So if you retire into a recession, that's going to have a very large impact on mm-hmm. the rest of your retirement versus if you retire into an up market, a great market, or even an average market. So we do have to take the first few years and be careful with what we're withdrawing from the portfolio, because we can't ignore the worst case scenario. That could certainly still happen. What my approach is, I don't want to ignore the good scenarios either. And so I did a lot of research on what are different approaches that we can take to spending. Anybody who's interested in this, I would direct them to Michael Kitchis. He's done a lot of research on it. And his work is really interesting there. Kitchis has a ratcheting rule, which I can just explain briefly. Mm-hmm. It's essentially you start with a floor. So say your withdrawal rate is 4%. That would be your floor. Right. And so $1 million portfolio, that's $40,000 in income. And what it allows for is your income to increase if certain conditions are met, just like ratcheting, but it will never decrease. So a rule, for example, might be if my portfolio grows by 50%, then I will increase spending by 10%. And maybe you limit your increases to once every 3 years. But it's a way that you allow yourself, if your portfolio is doing really well, to increase spending and actually start to enjoy some of that money. So mm-hmm. I like that approach because it never forces you to cut your spending. There are a few other approaches like guardrails approach to where you have a range like 3-5%. Mm-hmm. And if your withdrawal rate falls below 3%, then you can increase your spending. But if your withdrawal rate rises above 5%, then you will need to cut your spending. And many of us know that cutting spending is way more difficult than increasing spending. So I'm a bigger fan, and that's what Kitchis really created this rule around, is I don't want to have to cut spending. But what are the times where maybe we can allow ourselves to increase spending?
I like the sound of that. And I like, you know, any formula that we come up with, I think it's a good start. Mm-hmm. I think some people lose interest in even pursuing because the formula doesn't resonate with them. But you can tweak the formula and you can start with something and then see what works for you. I like the point you were making about the timing of the retirement, but it's also the timing of a liquidity event. I spend in this podcast quite a bit of time talking about the moment when people start investing or start the money story, the adult money story that they have in their life when they start to think about building something. If it's a bull market or a bear market, how it shapes them in a different way. But you point out something interesting, that the minute you retire and you're just retiring into a recession, a market correction, you might be setting yourself up for a different experience than somebody that just is going into a 2-3 year run-up in the market, and a very different experience. And the withdrawal rate will obviously translate to a different amount. And if you're withdrawing quite a bit into a more recessionary environment, you're going to deplete quite a bit of the amount that you had. So it's something to keep in mind and look outside the window. What kind of a year, what kind of an environment am I in, whether it's a liquidity event, you start mm-hmm. investing or retiring. I think that's very helpful. I like this thought that you share in one of the essays, which I think a lot of people should consider. You write that it's not all about beating the benchmark when it comes to investing, but it's all about creating an environment that encourages discipline and consistent investing. So focus on the process rather than checking every month or every quarter or every year, am I better or worse than the market? It kind of becomes secondary when you see it as a lifelong or even a multi-generational mm-hmm. pursuit. Can you talk about that consistency and discipline?
Yeah. And I think Buffett says in a better way, where he says, we don't have to be smarter than the rest. We just have to be more disciplined than the rest.
That's right.
So that's where a lot of this idea comes from, is some of the most, you know, intelligent investors out there who have the best degrees may not actually perform as well as you can if you can have more discipline in your investing. So there's what you invest in, which is very important, but there's also how you invest. And for many of us, we realize when we start investing that to become a great investor, you really have to go against human nature. And we are not designed to be good investors, because the time where it is most optimal to invest, to get into the market, is also the scariest time to get into the market. So the irony is that when people feel most comfortable investing in the market during market highs is actually the riskiest time to invest. And the time where it's actually the least riskiest time to invest is market lows. And that's when we're most terrified to get into it. So rather than waiting to see how we feel during the time, you mentioned this earlier, but automation is one of the best ways to create a disciplined environment, because it doesn't allow for your emotions to enter. As long as you can leave it alone, it should continue investing on a time schedule without your intervention at all. So some of the biggest mistakes I saw, especially when I was talking and dealing with people who had liquidity events, is we created a strategy, but it wasn't automated. We still needed to talk before we invested. And we would talk, and the person would maybe be spooked about the market and would want to wait, and they would hesitate. And then, of course, this happened a few times to where we did wait, and money was on the sidelines and the market was just taking off, and they missed some really valuable days. I think one of the best ways to encourage discipline around investing, one is automation, but two is education. Sometimes it's not a matter of just ignoring emotions or trying to suppress that, but it's a matter of understanding the market better and understanding how it works and how it has worked historically. And to have known that there's a lot of people in the past who have said, maybe it's different this time, and how dangerous those words are. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of charts that you can show people. One that I show all the time is the effects of missing just the 10 best market days over a 20-year time horizon, right, and how damaging that can be mm-hmm. to your portfolio. So showing people things like that and reiterating the importance of it's about time in the market rather than timing the market, it can have a really positive impact on allowing an investor to become more disciplined and being comfortable becoming more disciplined too.
You know, it brings back some memories. In my first book, Outsmarting the Crowd, I wrote how we're wired to fail with money. It's quite a big statement, but I wrote it back then because I thought our nature gets in the way of actually succeeding, especially in the public markets where you have a daily price quote that really gets to us. And having a certain discipline and kind of almost obstacles in the way, so that you're not going to act on hot news, on a hot tip on one side, and then a panic and fear on the other side. It's the idea that Buffett talks about: be fearful when others are greedy, be greedy when others are fearful the other way. And Munger adds to it that it's also the envy that comes to play. And I realize how many times when the neighbor is getting richer faster than you can derail the best plan. So it's something mm-hmm. worth considering. Because just because the neighbor looks rich doesn't mean that they're actually rich. So pause for a second and think for yourself. I want to ask you about retirement. You mentioned in one of your posts how people that you work with, they're looking at other ways of retiring. They are not interested in traditional retirement. What are the other paths that they're considering?
Yeah, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but with the clients, I work with a lot of millennials, and some people call them Henry's high earners, not rich yet. But I have not heard one of them yet say, I just want to retire at 65 and golf and go to the beach. Not a single person has said that. And maybe it has something to do with the way that I write online and I attract a certain group. But I also think there is this shift to where they saw their parents retire or their grandparents retire, and that was not interesting to them. That didn't look fun to them. And instead of that traditional retirement, they are chasing financial freedom. And it's not to stop working, but maybe to shift how they spend their days and to start a business. That's what a lot of people that I work with want to do, or to monetize a hobby that they have and just spend more time on that. Or maybe to take a sabbatical and just spend some time off of work and then go back into work and have a career change. But almost nobody says, I want to stop working entirely. Instead, it's, I want to work for a different reason. I want to work for impact. I want to maybe work for a charity or volunteer. And I want to not have to think about money anymore. So there is that point where they want to hit financial freedom because they believe it gives them the freedom to go after their interests and to go after what they really want. The irony and kind of the tragedy, I guess, behind it all is that some of these people get to this point or take the leap and do make the change and end up making more money than they ever did before. And it's because they've really allowed themselves to chase those interests. And it was something that felt more aligned with them than their previous work may have. So I consider myself really lucky to help people make that transition, not into retirement, but just into a different form of work.
Yeah, it's much more nuanced and I think a richer way of looking at the next stage or the multiple stages of your life. And it was interesting what you mentioned, which I also noticed. Once you reach a certain financial comfort, maybe if it's not a full financial freedom, according to any of the formulas we talked about, but some comfort, and you start to make different choices and maybe even tap into your real potential and follow through with some plans and passions that you had because you're comfortable, the money can actually follow quicker than you thought. Mm-hmm. I think that's the beauty of it all. I think that's fascinating to see how just because you're a bit more relaxed about it, you have enough not to worry about it, then something special can happen. Rachel, I want to ask you about that cabin in the mountain. So about the time we were scheduling this recording, which was a while back, you brought up something that you were spending some time in a cabin in the mountains with no internet and just focusing, regrouping, kind of a reset. You talked about sabbaticals a little bit, but that sounded like a mini sabbatical. Tell me about that experience. And does that happen often? Is that your practice?
Yeah. So this year, I think it might have started a little bit last year, but this year I've decided to split up my planning into quarters. And I call them 90-day sprints. This is where when you're a business owner and you create, what you quickly realize is there are so many opportunities and you either become paralyzed by how many things you can do, or you try to do several different things, but don't do any one of them really well. Mm-hmm. So once I realized this was happening, I decided to stop planning my years and start planning just the quarters. And I'd pick one or two, maybe three things to really focus on. But I realized I needed to disconnect and actually spend time thinking about what's the next thing that I need to focus on and reflecting on how the past quarter went. So I started these little mini retreats. I would just get away for a long weekend. The idea was to try to be in nature and to not have cell service or internet if we could avoid that. That's when I found I did the most planning, or the best planning, I should say. And the realization around it is I think we are constantly distracted by emails, by internet. It's so easy to quickly distract ourselves. And so when I put myself in an environment where I can't grab my phone or get on the internet, it really forces me to become a little bit bored, but then to start thinking deeper about things. So I went to this last one was, yeah, Cabin in the Mountains in the San Juan mountain range. And I went there thinking, I'm just going to create a business plan for quarter four. And I did do that, but I also came away, this was the most, the most restricted I had been in any of these retreats as far as internet, cell service, things like that. I didn't have it for like three solid days. And so I went away, created the business plan, but then also came away from that realizing that I was hurting one of what I think is the most important skill sets to have. And that's the ability to think deeply. When you look at people like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, they dedicate a lot of time to just sitting there and thinking. And during our day, you know, we can become so busy that we don't have even a few minutes to sit there and think. So I had all that time to be in that cabin, to be bored and to start thinking. And I realized that that was when I was the most creative and when I was thinking the most logically about things, when I had the best ideas. So I wanted to take some of those moments and try to bring them into my everyday life and to create space to where I could just allow myself to think. And a big way to do that, I realized, was to not allow myself to jump on social media, jump on emails. So I took all of that off of my phone. So now when I go on social media or I go to check email, I have to be really intentional about it. But it just allows for fewer distractions in my everyday life to open up space to think a little bit more and to be more intentional with every day.
I like the sound of that, and I can relate. My wife and I spend quite a bit of time in different cabins in the woods in Pennsylvania and Georgia in different times, and I wrote about it in some of my essays, and some people found it amusing. But I think that time of disconnect really allows you to hear your own voice, especially when you're living in a big city. There's so many distractions, meetings, lunches, events, and then I think to just pause for a second and have an extended time when nothing is getting in the way can create an opportunity for really fun things to come up, maybe older ideas, maybe new ideas, and just that deep, deep work. And there's a wonderful book about it. Cal Newport wrote about it. But I think there's some truth to it, that we think that we're doing work by jumping from a task to a task to a task. But if you have a whole day when nothing is getting in the way, I think bigger ideas and bigger visions can come up. So I like that thought. Rachel, I have one last big question for you. I like to ask my guests about their definition of success. How do you think about success?
Yeah, I think about it in simple terms. I think these complicated questions sometimes are best answered as simply as you can. And it's simply to wake up, to be able to do more of what I want to do with my day, more of what I love doing, and less of what I dislike doing. And I constantly remind myself that the most important thing I can have in this life is my relationships. And really, it's all we have. So if I can spend more time with my friends, with my families, if I can form and create deeper relationships, then I don't see any better purpose than that. I do think it's a privilege to be able to do that. And you do have to work to get to that point. You're probably there, so you get to be there sooner than you think you are. But there, I do still see success as taking care of my finances as a way to create ownership over my schedule so that I can spend more time doing those exact things.
I think it's a beautiful way to think about it. And your work, I think, shares a lot of that kind of inspiration, encouragement with other people to see that there is a way. And I think that one moment when somebody sees that there's an opportunity to get there, I think it's very satisfying, rewarding to help them get mm-hmm. there and be a part of their experience. So, Rachel, I had a lot of fun talking to you today. I feel like we touched on a lot of wonderful topics, so I really appreciate it. And I feel the audience will walk away with some big ideas that maybe will, you know, change some lives. Who knows? But that's my hope.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
Wow. You are listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes, and so are the opinions of the host, an employee and partner of a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on the firm is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available on advisorinfo.sec.gov.